Hey everyone out there, and thanks for joining us again here at ASAP Nowcast, the podcast for ASAP Now. Now, for those of us just joining us, welcome. And for those of us rejoining us, thanks for coming back. You guys probably know the shtick. We feature either something from the magazine or some special podcast-only content to give a little more in-depth coverage of all things emergency medicine directly to you. Now, I think a lot of us join emergency medicine because we love the diversity of clinical cases that we get. So I am always down for a cool clinical pearl. Now, we had something in the magazine this month, though, that caught my eye because it wasn't one of the core, let's say, chief complaints or diagnoses that we see. It wasn't another article about chest pain or PEs or COPD or SBOs or appendicitis. It was something that I think is becoming more common and burgeoning in society. So something we're seeing more complications of, and that is BBLs or Brazilian butt lifts. Now, our authors were out of Miami, which is definitely an epicenter of some of these cosmetic procedures. But what I thought was really interesting is because there is so much medical traveling for these procedures, that is, patients go to somewhere to get particularly cosmetic procedures done, and then we'll go back home. We are starting to see this in ERs across the nation, regardless if you are a center or a place where those procedures are common. So I found it really interesting because not only are cosmetic procedures increasing, not only are they sometimes quite invasive, they're also not particularly regulated sometimes. So it doesn't seem like a surprise that we are seeing more complications. So we sat down with a couple of the authors of the article to chat more. Come and check it out. Hey everyone at ASAP Now, thanks again for joining us for an interview about a clinical topic that I don't think we get to talk about a ton, but that I thought was a really interesting feature in the ASAP Now magazine this month. So we have joining us today Dr. Mary Bridget Lee, who's a PGY2 at Jackson Memorial, and Dr. Matthew Pyle, who's an attending at Jackson Memorial, here to talk to us about something that is a little bit uniquely Miami, let's say. So Mary Bridget and Matt, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, thanks for having us.
So let's just launch right in. BBL is the topic we are talking about. So tell me, what is that?
Great question. BBL stands for Brazilian butt lift, which is the colloquial term for a cosmetic surgery procedure that's an autologous fat transfer to the glutes. So what that involves is doing an abdominoplasty or liposuction of the abdomen. Usually, sometimes patients will have liposuction of other parts of their body as well. And then that fat is re-injected into the gluteal space in order to create a more curvy silhouette. And it's quite popular in Miami.
Yeah. And, you know, so I practice in Texas and I have definitely seen not only cases coming over from people based in Miami, but also a lot of people traveling down to Mexico for this procedure. They stay for like a week or something, and then they come back with all their drains and everything still in place. So that was actually the reason I thought this was such an interesting topic, is I'm like, oh, I think we all see this. So tell me, on the BBLs, or I guess the professional term is autologous fat transfers, like, to be really explicitly clear, this is entirely supposed to be extraperitoneal. Like, you're not going in the abdomen at all. Like, it is moving external adipose tissue, correct?
That's right.
Okay. And what I've noticed, and you guys talk about this too, is that these cases are increasing and that people are, you know, doing it more and talking about it more. Do you guys have any concept of, like, who's doing these surgeries? Like, we see the complications, but, like, are they board certified plastics? Are they all physicians? Like, you know, like, are they just little clinics where people just walk in and then, like, walk out with drains, I guess?
Yeah, it's really hard to know a lot of the details about a lot of these procedures that are happening in Miami. The national Cosmetic Surgery Association has some voluntary reporting on the numbers of these procedures that are being done, but it's all voluntary reporting. Based on those numbers, we can tell that the overall rate of BBLs or autologous fat transfer procedures is increasing exponentially, but there's no overarching regulatory body. And in Miami, we've seen a lot of these standalone cosmetic surgery clinics sprouting up around town. They can really be run by anyone. And for a while, there was no requirement for the surgeon to be board certified in plastic surgery. And there were a lot of lax regulations regarding these, which actually led to some recent regulations passed by the Florida Board of Medicine to try to rein in some of the practices that were happening at those clinics.
Wow. So it's basically kind of state by state, it sounds like, if that, of who's doing this, but no one's really governing it.
Right. And yeah. Florida, for example, they had to put in restrictions on how many of these procedures could be performed by one physician per day. They had to mandate the use of ultrasound to make sure that specifically the reinjection of the fat was happening superficially and not into the muscle. So it sort of seems to be regulations crop up as problems crop up.
Yeah, so it's no surprise then that we are seeing complications in the ER. So I would love for you guys to tell me about, like, what's the classic case that you see in the ER surrounding this?
The classic case, I think probably every resident at Jackson can remember the first time that they saw a BBL patient come in, because they're very distinctive looking. And, you know, I moved to Miami for residency. I had no experience down here before, and certainly no experience with these AFT patients. The classic patient is wheeled in either on a stretcher or on a wheelchair, and they're distinctive because they will, on a stretcher, be in a prone position, or if they're in a wheelchair, they'll actually be standing on the wheelchair because they are not supposed to put any pressure on the site of the fat reinjection on the glutes. And so they'll be kind of contorted in these weird positions, and then they are wearing these constrictive post-surgical garments called fajas, which are sort of like corset-type binders, and they often have multiple JP drains, and they are often very pale and plus or minus covered in blood, honestly.
And what brought them to the ER?
The most common chief complaints, we've been looking back through the medical record at Jackson, the most common chief complaints are around pain and bleeding.
And a lot of these still have drains, right? Like, the few of these I've seen, again, usually from actually Mexico, not so much Miami, just because of where I'm based. They come, well, I'm like, I don't know where these drains are going, but they have stuff in them.
Yes, a lot of them come with JP drains still in.
Okay. And usually, what do you feel like their expectation is for, like, what they want from the ER? Is it just like pain medicine? Are they getting sent without anything? Is it that drains are falling out? Is it that they're spiking fevers? Like, what's probably the common? And then we'll move into the critical.
I think the most common scenario that patients find themselves in is that they've traveled from out of town for this procedure. Like you mentioned, we've found super high rates of out-of-state patients being treated here at Jackson. And a lot of them have tried to arrange some sort of post-surgery care at a recovery home of some sort. And I think they often find the care there lacking. And so they come with sort of expected post-surgical changes and symptoms like pain and bleeding. Mm-hmm. And they don't have adequate support here to take care of them. So I think patients are coming in looking for pain medications, looking to have some labs to make sure that they're not bleeding too much, maybe get rehydrated with some fluids.
Okay. And I think this probably goes without saying, but I wanted to clarify, at least to the best of you guys' knowledge, like, the initial surgeon that did the surgery has absolutely no obligation the treat these complications. And I'm sure that surgeon is largely inaccessible to you guys in the ER, right?
Correct. Yeah. Usually at least in their ER visit, the surgeon that performed the initial surgery is not involved at all. And sometimes the patients don't even remember the name of the surgeon or the name of the center that did the surgery.
Oh man. And so what do you do then? Like, I mean, do you take them out of the faja? Do you look at the drains and like, are like, okay, like, do you see them, CT them to make sure that the drains aren't going somewhere they shouldn't be? Or like, what's the approach?
Yeah, I think every patient is different. And so you have to go based on what their chief complaint is and what the clinical picture in front of you is. But I would say for most of these patients, we are taking that constrictive garment off and taking a look at all of the surgical sites. These patients will often have multiple points of entry for the liposuction and the reinjection. So they might have multiple small surgical sites. Taking a look at all of those, doing a good abdominal exam briefly, though, because they can't be on their back for too long. Mm-hmm. And then taking a look at the backside and any signs of tissue necrosis, excessive bleeding, infection, if it's been a little while since their procedure. And then checking a set of labs, making sure that their hemoglobin is okay. Actually, a lot of these patients will know what their pre-op hemoglobin was. That's something that seems to be screened at the cosmetic surgery centers. And so the patients can tell you, oh, it was 13 before I went in for surgery, which is really helpful. And getting some fluid started for the patient.
Okay. So it's mostly like make them feel better and then go on to healing process, hopefully.
Yes.
Okay. Now I think when it gets into the critical, you guys talked about this. Because you talked about it in the article, tell us what's like the most critical, like, oh, they come coding diagnosis. How do you get there? Like, walk me through that. So I thought this was really interesting.
Yeah. The most critical complication to watch out for in these fat transfer procedures is a fat embolism. There's sort of two schools of thought about them. The sort of classic idea is that when they are re-injecting the fat, the surgeon accidentally injects the fat into a vessel and it causes a big embolism blockage that would cause any symptoms of any embolism. And then there's another school of thought that there's also a more delayed sort of fat embolism syndrome, which is where small molecules of fat diffuse into the bloodstream and cause a sort of systemic inflammatory reaction. That first classic injecting fat into the vessel one is still the scariest complication and will often happen immediately on the OR table. And so those patients may not even make it to the emergency room or they come in as a full-blown cardiac arrest. And it is also thought that when you flip the patient onto their back after the surgery, that can be a really critical time where that fat may embolize. Unfortunately, there's not really anything special or any magic bullet for those patients. They should be run as a cardiac arrest would be run in your shop. But the more delayed systemic inflammatory response is something to keep in mind that might present a little bit later. Still supportive care for those patients, but those might not come in straight from the OR as an arrest kind of picture.
It's interesting. So I'm almost like, I know on autopsy, like hopefully you'll find it, but in otherwise in a patient that like has this look of having gotten a BBL, like, I mean, you do CPR, like is TPA helpful? Like, is this, you know, like, do you treat it in the way you would treat like any other PE? It's funny because it's a fat embolism, which also should be, we would assume, transient.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Pyle, but I don't think that TPA has been shown to be helpful in fat embolisms. And it's difficult too, because most of the literature on fat embolisms that we have comes from orthopedic surgery, which is where these were, you know, initially and most popularly described. There's not a lot of literature about the post BBL complications yet.
Yeah, that's all true. And I would say with the BBL patient specifically, giving TPA, given how many of our patients had bleeding complications in a cardiac arrest, it would sort of be 50-50 whether it was a hemorrhagic cause of their cardiac arrest. And so TPA could also be incredibly counterproductive.
Yeah, and you guys had this shocking stat, I thought, that 37% of patients presenting after this procedure to you guys required transfusion. So I'm like, I didn't realize how bloody these can be. So it's an interesting, like, not only is pulmonary fat embolisms, I think, interesting, but then two, like, the management, I think, is literally just, you know, normal ACLS CPR and, like, hope. I mean, that's almost always how we approach things, though.
Yeah, I think for these patients, they look really scary coming in because of, you know, everything that we've described. They're in these constrictive garments. They're positioned unusually. But really, most of their problems are problems that emergency medicine physicians are very comfortable dealing with and treating. And the most important thing is to not be, you know, too alarmed by the fact that it's a BBL and just proceed as you normally would treating these issues as you find them.
Yeah. And I wanted to talk dispo with you because you guys, again, had, I think, a pretty impressive statistics that almost half of all these post-procedure patients in your ED required admission. And then I think 6% or something required ICU admission. In these instances, because it is like almost a, you know, they got orphaned by their surgeon, like in my system, which admittedly is a big one. And so it's a giant network of surgeons, et cetera. Like, we would definitely only talk to the surgeon that did the procedure. If not, we would actually consider transferring to the center in the area that did said procedure. However, in this case, that's generally not the option. Like, do you guys see these going, you know, to like general surgery? Do these go to medicine mostly? I know it depends on the reason for admission too. You guys, you know, mentioned that bowel perforation happens in this, in addition to, you know, the usual electrolyte things, infection, et cetera.
Yeah. So looking at our data, about 45% of patients were able to be discharged from the ER. The rest were admitted to some level of care. I think some patients, it's pretty straightforward. They come in because they couldn't get their pain medication refilled, or they, you know, had uncontrolled pain. They weren't sent with any pain. Other patients are a little more complex. And I think if patients got blood transfusions or had abnormal vital signs, we have kind of a low threshold to admit them because we know that they're oftentimes, especially the out-of-state patients, don't have a lot of social support in the area and people that can help take care of them. That said, I have never admitted one of these patients to general surgery. They almost uniformly go to the medical team, and the plastic surgery service will consult on them.
Okay, very cool. And if you had to have some takeaways, because obviously Miami, and I'm sure Jackson Memorial, is like very familiar with this patient presentation. But for people that aren't, like, i.e., you know, a patient that went and got a BBL somewhere and then went back home, but, you know, their home city's not a place that normally sees a whole lot of this. What are some takeaways for ER doctors?
Some of the takeaways are, it's a cosmetic surgery procedure, and I think people can look at that as being sort of superficial and not that serious, but it has the potential to be very serious and should be taken seriously by the physician seeing the patient in the ER. At the same time, the complications that these patients get are familiar to ER physicians. We know how to evaluate them and treat them. And if you go based on how your patient looks, what their vital signs are, what your workup is showing, then you should be fine taking care of these patients.
Awesome. It's kind of like, no matter what, right? That's like what we do as ER doctors, is we see anything that can come through the door. And so this is no exception.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Lee, Dr. Pyle, super appreciate both of you guys coming on and chatting about this. Like I said, kind of a unique clinical presentation I thought was worth a feature. But I want to say thank you guys for coming on and elaborating more.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks again to Dr. Lee and Dr. Pyle. These were super cool clinical pearls and a discussion of something we don't necessarily see all the time in our EDs, at least not yet. Now that is it for us this month. And as always, the podcast is just a few snippets that we get to feature of the magazine or of emergency medicine. So there's tons more in the full magazine hitting your inboxes. So from the clinical standpoint, be sure to check out our pieces on asthma, hypertension, UTIs, measles, strokes. And as always, we have lots about emergency medicine as an industry and as a practice. We have a great feature and discussion with Dr. Dan Mayer on lawsuits. And it is 50 years of EMS, celebrated by EMS Week. So we got a great article on that as well. Now, tweet us, as always, if you got an idea or something you'd like for us to feature, at ASAPNow, or feel free to tweet me direct, at Amy Faith Ho. We love getting your feedback to hear your thoughts and keep you tuning in. So thanks, everyone, for joining us again, and we will see you all next time.